Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the San Diego Performance Academy. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. Republican Congressman Duncan Hunter has long been known as a hawk on military matters, but in an interview on C-SPAN's Washington Journal this week, the former Marine who represents much of East County went further, voicing support for use of tactical nuclear weapons if and only if the U.S. launches an airstrike against Iran. He backed use of tactical nuclear weapons designed for the battlefield to halt Iran's reported efforts to develop a nuclear weapon and, in his words, to, quote, set them back a decade or two or three. Hunter's district includes over 80,000 Middle Eastern immigrants. He also ignited controversy when he stated, in the Middle Eastern culture, it is looked upon with very high regard to get the best deal possible no matter what it takes. That includes lying, he said. You can view his full interview on our website at eastcountymagazine.org. Now, in an email to East County Magazine, Hunter's chief of staff, Joe Casper, advised that Hunter didn't actually call for a strike against Iran, but meant that if action is needed, boots on the ground is unrealistic. We don't have conventional resources to do the job, he said, and that leaves specific devices to penetrate bunkers, etc. That is not a situation we ever want to be in, with that the only option if needed, underscoring why Iran should have less and not more room to weaponize, Casper told us. An editorial in U.S. News and World Report blasted Hunter's stance. It said, "These are not the words of an American statesman, nor should it be acceptable language for a member of Congress to suggest that a preventive first-strike attack against Iran would be an appropriate policy." The editorial noted that even a conventional air attack would, quote, "inflame already explosive tensions in the Middle East and spark a regional war that could easily rage for decades. To drop nuclear bombs as part of a massive aerial bombardment campaign, furthermore, could risk the scale of death and destruction seen in U.S. nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki," U.S. World and News Report concluded. James Kimber, a Democrat, has announced his plans to run against Hunter in the 50th District. He said, "Mr. Hunter's remarks are incredibly irresponsible at a time when the administration is trying diplomacy with Iran." He added that Hunter's comments show ignorance or arrogance by suggesting that nuclear weapons could be used without thrusting the rest of the world into conflict. Ben Colasio is president of the new San Diego East County Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce, which represents Chaldean Christians from Iraq. Colasio told 10 News that Hunter should apologize for his remarks about Middle Easterners. He said, "It's not in good taste. I think a lot of people will take offense to that." He added that many Middle Easterners are sickened by the notion of violence. Hunter spokesman Casper later told 10 News that Hunter wasn't talking about Middle East culture generally, but rather the political culture in certain Middle Eastern nations. The American-Iranian Council has launched a petition calling on Hunter to apologize. So far, over 1,600 people have signed it. In recent days, prominent conservatives have been largely silent on the controversy, suggesting that perhaps even many pro-military Republicans may view Hunter's support for use of nuclear weapons, even in an airstrike, as extremist. One notable exception is Sheldon Adelson, a top political donor to Republican candidates. Defense News reports that back in October, Adelson also called on the U.S. to deploy a nuclear weapon against Iran, although he favored using a nuclear bomb in a remote location as a warning for Iran to cease its nuclear program. Some prominent political leaders have, however, indicated concerns over the potential threat that nuclear weapons in the hands of Iran's leaders could pose to U.S. forces, to Israel, or to other U.S. allies. In July 2012, the U.S. State Department released a report on terrorism. The report stated that Iran remained an active state sponsor of terrorism in 2011 and continued to provide financial, material, and logistical support for terrorist and militant groups throughout the Middle East and Central Asia. The report states that Iran has continued to provide lethal support, including weapons, training, funding, and guidance, to Iraqi Shia militant groups targeting the U.S. and Iraqi forces, as well as civilians. Iran has also backed forces that support the Taliban in Afghanistan and provided arms to Hezbollah. Tactical nuclear weapons are typically designed for battlefield use, but can also be used to penetrate underground bunkers or in missiles, torpedoes, or other devices. By contrast, non-tactical nuclear weapons are intended for use against cities to weaken an enemy's ability to wage war. To date, the United States is the only nation ever to deploy nuclear weapons during World War II and the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan. While the yield of tactical nuclear weapons is generally lower than non-tactical ones, some tactical nuclear weapons are actually more powerful than any nuclear explosions that have thus far occurred. The Federation of American Scientists has predicted that launching the least powerful tactical nuclear weapons in the U.S. arsenal would blow out a huge crater of radioactive material, creating a lethal gamma radiation field over a very large area. The scientists indicate that if the U.S. were to use a more powerful tactical nuclear weapon, like the B-61, the explosion could be many times more powerful than the atomic weapon the United States dropped on Hiroshima, incinerating numerous Iranian citizens in urban centers near the nation's nuclear facilities. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine's Tribal Beat. And today we're honored to have Rose Margaret Arantia in our Santee studio. Ms. Arantia was named Local Hero by Union Bank and KPBS for the 2013 American Indian Heritage Month for her commitment to Indigenous traditions and culture and to improving the lives of Native Americans and their families. Welcome.
Thank you.
Let me begin by asking you about your involvement and your knowledge of the Indian Child Welfare Act that was passed back in 1978.
So my involvement was that at the beginning when funding was made available, I ran an Indian Child Welfare Program that served tribal families in San Diego and Riverside counties. So the program provided prevention services so that if families were in trouble, we could go in and help to provide services so that the families would not be disrupted, so that they wouldn't be broken apart. When that failed, then we had foster homes that were licensed foster homes, and children could go there temporarily while the parents worked on their reunification plan to get their children back. In those cases where, unfortunately, the parents did not reunify, we were also a state-licensed adoption agency, and we had Indian homes all over. We served the 12 southernmost counties in California. So we were able to go and find adoptive families throughout that whole region. And so we ensured that if Indian children had to be adopted, they could be adopted by Indian families.
So what was it like before that?
Well, the Indian Child Welfare Act was actually legislated because the Congress had set up a commission. The commission had four task forces. The commission was set up in 1976, and there was a great deal of testimony, people from tribal people from all over the country. And at that time, it was discovered that Indian children were being removed at a rate much higher than other children, anywhere from 3 to 4 times the rate. So there were some villages throughout the country where every single child had been removed. And so it was clear to the Congress that this was an epidemic of children being removed and placed in non-Indian homes. Mm-hmm. And the outcomes for these children were not good. American Indian youth had the highest rate of suicide, 8 times higher than any other population in the country. Nice. So we knew that removing the children and placing them out of culture created the sorts of problems that would cause, young people to despair and to kill themselves. And besides that, there were all these other issues that came up with that. There was the abuse of substances, alcohol, drugs. So it was, for these young people, it was not a good outcome, and that had to change. The Congress recognized it, and the Indian Child Welfare Act was passed in November of 1978. Mm-hmm. And so Indian Child Welfare Act programs began throughout the country.
And did the act have any teeth or funding at first?
Well, at the beginning, the act was passed in 1978, but the Congress didn't actually appropriate money until 1980. That's when the funding started.
And that funding didn't just come automatically.
Well, when they first started doing it, the first 2 years, I believe it was the first 2 years, they just took the money and divided it up by how many tribes there were. And then each tribe got X amount of dollars. Here in San Diego, two of the tribes got together and they pooled their money and they did assessments. So they went to all the tribes and asked, you know, what the issues were in terms of needing services for the children. Uh-huh. And they developed a 501c3 that was named the Indian Child Welfare Consortium. Uh-huh. And so that's how they began to do business. And I actually came to work there in 1984. So by that time, they had already been in existence for about 4 years and had been receiving funding. The funding was all done on a competitive basis after the first 2 years. Mm-hmm. So there was a pool of money that was appropriated. And then every Indian tribe and Indian organization that was eligible could apply for that funding. And because the funding was limited, all the tribes did not get services. All the tribes did not have funding. So
really? That
wasn't the best way to, you know, to approach doing this work, but it was better than it was before.
So now it's divided more by the need than by arbitrarily?
After doing it by a competitive grant writing, they went back to doing it, you know, giving each tribe a little bit of money. Uh-huh. And if you take the money that's allocated and you divide it up by all the tribes in the country, you'll see that the amounts that people get are very small.
Yeah, you know, at one time in your biography, it says you were at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Indian Arts in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Now, that sounds interesting.
Well, the Institute of American Indian Arts was founded in the 60s by then Secretary of the Interior, Udall. It was an interesting concept. They decided to make a national school for young American Indian youth that wanted to become artists. And there was already a history in Santa Fe at the Indian School in Santa Fe. They already had a really well-known art program. So they decided to use that particular site and the momentum of that program that was already there. There were many already painters that had been trained there and that were out and some of them making a living from, you know, they're actually from their art. So then the Institute came into being. Once again, it was a national school, so young people came there from all over the country, including Alaska. Mm-hmm. And it started out being a high school. They had the 4 years of high school, and then they had 2 years of postgraduate work. And then by the time I came to work there in 1967, they began to do away with the high school portion of it. So every year they would just eliminate another grade until it was just a postgraduate school. By the time I left, it was just a postgraduate school.
So you've been working with young people for, was that your start in working as a
My real start was when I graduated from college, I went into the Peace Corps and lived and worked in Peru among the Quechua people there.
Oh.
So that was my very first beginning. So it was a program that was called Food for Peace.
Uh-huh.
So the United States would send commodities down to these countries and then they would sort of sit on the docks and rot because...
Uh-huh.
First of all, folks didn't know how to use them because they were foods that were not natural
familiar.
Or
uh-huh.
familiar to folks, or else they would appear on the black market. But they
uh-huh.
weren't getting to the people for whom it was intended. So the program that I went down to work with was called Food for Peace, and our job was to set up school feeding programs in the schools in the villages that we were sent to. So then we taught the mothers how to use the ingredients to provide meals for their kids.
Which were what?
Primarily powdered milk, and the mothers wouldn't use it because they had been told that it was something that the Americans sent down there, and it was the ground-up bones of our dead.
Oh, no.
So there was this, they were absolutely not going to use it. So part of what we did was to do some education around, uh-huh. This is powdered milk, and this is how you reconstitute it, this is how you use it. And they would send down things such as bulgur wheat,
uh-huh.
which was not something that was part of the diet down there. So we really needed to teach people how to cook it and how to use it. And the same thing, they sent cornmeal, which we made cornmeal mush from. By the time the group that I went with, there were four of us at the beginning, and then there were two. We were feeding about 5,000 kids breakfast every day. And it was, for some of them, the only meal they got. So,
wow.
So when we did the school feeding, we fed not only the children, but of course the mothers would come and help prepare the food,
uh-huh.
and then we would have them bring any siblings that were at home, whether they were in school or not.
Uh-huh.
So we tried to feed everybody.
So you went from the Peace Corps then to the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe, and you're working with young Native Americans and Alaska Natives who are aspiring to be artists.
That's
that must
correct.
Have been.
It was phenomenal to be there. I've never seen so much talent.
Uh-huh.
I've never seen people with young people just so filled with talent. And it wasn't just talent in one area. You know, they could paint, they could sculpt, they wrote poetry, they wrote songs, they sang. It was just amazing. Just amazing.
So tell us about what you're doing now, which recently you've been involved in the Tribal Star program. So would you tell us what Tribal Star is?
So I've been doing Tribal Star for 10 years now. So Tribal Star is a program of the Academy for Professional Excellence. The Academy is a program of the San Diego State School of Social Work.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of five regional training academies in the state of California. And the charge of the academies is to train all new social workers who are going to be working with families and children in the state. The charge of Tribal Star in particular is that we develop curricula and develop and deliver training for social workers, helping them to learn how to do engagement with the tribal communities that they're going to encounter, with tribal families, tribal children, how to work with the tribes, how to work with the tribal ICWA programs so that the children get the best services possible and that the families have the best chance for reunification. So that's what we do. We also have an annual celebration where we celebrate and honor our partners that have done exceptional work throughout the year. So that's something we've been doing now for 10 years.
And I noticed you were honored in 2012 for
yes.
your contributions.
Right. Well, they sneak things in on me sometimes.
Well, social work is so important, but it seems to be so underappreciated. Is it still that way?
Well, it's one of those jobs where most of the time you don't get to see the rewards of your work. You don't get to see what children turn out like, you know, after you've uh-huh. you've done the work that you've done. You don't get to see that.
Yes.
So it can be discouraging.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes it feels like the only thing you ever see is the worst part of humanity, not the best. But then there are those occasions where you know that you've done a really good job
uh-huh.
and their family has reunified and that children are safe and the family is together again. So that's why you do the work.
So that leads to my last question, and that is, how are we doing now from your unique perspective?
Well, in terms of the Indian Child Welfare Act, what I will say is the statistics have not changed significantly.
Mm-hmm.
We still have a disproportionate number of Indian children that come into the child welfare system, and that needs to change. The disparity and disproportionality occurs in the African American and American Indian communities.
Uh-huh.
So that's something that everybody knows, and yet somehow we're not able to understand why that is. We have some ideas about why it is. You know, with Indian families, there's been a tradition of removing Indian children. There's
mm-hmm.
been a tradition of adopting Indian children out to non-Indian families.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, these are things that are historical. And so there are things that we need to work on and that we need to change. And we need to be sure that the Indian Child Welfare Act is implemented
mm-hmm.
at every step when a child comes into care, so that we don't wind up with situations like baby Veronica, where here's a young child that was removed and her father is perfectly willing to care for her, and yet the courts have decided that this child will be adopted out to a non-Indian family. So we need to make every effort to make sure that our children stay connected to culture,
mm-hmm.
that they stay connected to their community,
mm-hmm.
and that they stay in their families. Because for Indian children, the outcomes when they're not placed in culture are not good outcomes. Our children have higher rates of suicide. This is something that's been historical, and we know that loss of identity leads to that. So, you know, for our children, when they're placed out of culture, it can mean a death sentence. So
mm-hmm.
we need to be careful. We need to be thoughtful. And we need to ensure that those who work with our children understand how dire the consequences can be,
mm-hmm.
and again, that we implement the act from the very first moment until those children are back with their families, and if they can't be reunited with their families, that they're living within culture with an Indian family, so that they will have good outcomes.
I want to thank you so much for being here. We definitely appreciate what you've done, and it's made a big difference And it's great to see you recognized for the work that you've done. And thank you so much for coming to East County Magazine.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And I just need for everybody to know that the honors are not a personal thing with me. I always accept them for all of those who do this work every day. It's hard work. And for our tribal community, for our ICWA workers, don't give up the fight.
This is a public service announcement for the Mountain Health and Community Services. Mountain Health and Community Services is looking for a happy ending for a Christmas toy story. Serving rural areas of East County and other parts of San Diego for over 30 years, the nonprofit health organization needs hundreds of toys donated to give to low-income children at Christmas holiday parties this year. Usually, the organization receives a grant for 400 toys from Mattel Toy, but this year that did not come through. These toys go to underserved kids in Hakumba, Campo, Alpine, downtown San Diego, and Escondido, so they need community help this year to help these children have a happy holiday season. They're asking anybody who can help to provide new unwrapped toys for children of all ages, boys and girls. The organization is also collecting canned and dry foods for the Campo Food Pantry, which helps local low-income families. Items needed include pasta, pasta sauces, tuna, peanut butter, cereals, and similar items. Toys and canned goods can be dropped off until December 17th at the Alpine Family Medicine at 1620 Alpine Boulevard in Alpine, or the Mountain Empire Family Medicine at 3115 Highway 94 in Campo. The holiday parties are always a big event. They include a family meal, crafts, toys for the children, a chat with Santa, and shopping at Santa's workshop. For more information or to volunteer to help the Mountain Health and Community Services with these events, visit www.mtnhealth.org.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. This week abounds with holiday activities with some art, hiking, and local music in our inland regions. Downtown La Mesa is decorated and ready for its annual Christmas in the Village event, which happens from 5 to 10 p.m., on Friday and Saturday, December 13th and 14th. A holiday parade starts at 5 p.m. both days. This free event, held on La Mesa Boulevard between Spring Street and Acacia Avenue, will feature carolers, horse-drawn carriages, craft vendors, and street entertainers. On December 11th at 6 p.m., the curtain will rise at the Viejas Dream Catchers Lounge to reveal the results of this year's Viejas Holiday Toy Drive. Their goal is to bring in donations of 10,000 toys to brighten the holidays for East County families in need. The Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Indians joins in the 39th annual East County Toy Drive to support Stoney's Kids and Salvation Army of East County. You must be 18 or over to attend. The Pine Creek Posse Band will be playing this Friday and Saturday night at Don's Cocktail Lounge on Business Highway 8 in El Cajon. This country band, which also plays rock and roll, performed at East County Magazine's Wild West Fest this summer at Descanso Town Hall. The Salvation Army Croc Center, Croc's Kids Junior Theater Company, presents the holiday classic Babes in Toyland, with some fresh new music throughout the weekend of December 13th through 15th at the Joan B. Kroc Theater. Showtime is 7 p.m. both Friday and Saturday, and 2 p.m. on Sunday. This family-friendly performance features more than 30 local children, ages 8 to 17 years. Barona Cultural Center and Museum presents its annual holiday kids craft class. Children ages 5 to 11 are invited to join the museum staff for an afternoon of snacks and crafts on Saturday, December 14th, from 10:30 a.m. until noon. Participants will meet at the Barona Community Room of the Barona Cultural Center and Museum, located on Barona Road in Lakeside, to create a unique holiday ornament using traditional gourds and contemporary decorations in this interactive class. Space is limited and requires an RSVP. Christmas in the Valley at Bates Nut Farm and Valley Center will be held Friday and Saturday, December 13th and 14th. One can board the Polar Express hayride for a special meeting with St. Nick. Check out a gingerbread house competition held on the 14th. Enjoy kids' activities, shop for gifts, and more. Hours on December 13th are 4 to 8 p.m. and on December 14th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. For a complete schedule, one can visit their website at www.batesnutfarm.biz. Admission is free. Paint and Palette. Guests can find their inner Picasso as they paint and drink wine on Wednesday, December 11th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the San Pasquale Winery Tasting Room and Gallery on La Mesa Boulevard in the Village of La Mesa. San Pasquale Winery provides everything participants need, including a 16 by 20 canvas, supplies, art apron, and step-by-step instructions by a local artist. No art experience is required. The theme for this wine and art workshop is Venice. The oil paintings of S.C. Mummert, a rare painter who creates both landscapes and figurative work, will be exhibited at Audun Fine Art Gallery on Thursday, December 12th from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. The Audun Gallery is located on La Mesa Boulevard in La Mesa. Viewers will be able to meet the artist and also experience the guitar stylings of Jose Molino Serrano. Age limit is 18 and above. A free East County Bluegrass Jam will be held on Saturday, December 14th from noon to 3 p.m. Musicians and listeners alike are invited to a bluegrass jam held in the garden area of the local Mercantile, a historic building that is home to a large antique mall and a coffee shop located on Business Highway 8 in El Cajon. Novices and experts are welcomed. Old Poway Park is celebrating Christmas in the Park, a festival that brings Christmas traditions to life, on Saturday, December 14th from 3:30 to 8:30 p.m. Guests can make holiday ornaments, listen to caroling and live holiday entertainment, write a letter to U.S. troops overseas, shop for gifts, see an N model railroad train display, enjoy a horse-drawn hayride, be part of the Christmas tree lighting, see Santa and Mrs. Claus arrive by train, and more. Admission is free, and there will be free shuttles from two locations into the park on Midland Road in Poway. Visit www.poway.org for a list of individual events and their times, as well as shuttle information. Candlelight Angel Light is a free musical program in the College Avenue area of San Diego. The Cedar Center Chorus and Pacific Airs will perform holiday music and classical selections directed by Eunice Williams on Saturday, December 14th from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. at the College Avenue Baptist Church on College Avenue in San Diego. The first annual Pine Valley Christmas celebration takes place on Saturday, December 14th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Pine Valley Clubhouse. A spaghetti dinner will be served from 5 to 7 p.m. Other activities for the evening will be a silent auction, bake sale, vendors, the arrival of Santa and caroling. The Christmas tree lighting and parade begins at 7 p.m. down Old Highway 80 with prizes for the best decorated vehicle. The Acumba hikers and walkers will be leading an easy hike into Fossil Canyon, just west of Ocotillo, on Saturday, December 14th. This hike is easygoing enough for kids and novice hikers and is also dog-friendly. Hikers meet at the Chevron gas station south of I-8 off the Ocotillo exit at 9 a.m. Live music and dancing happens each Saturday night at the Bailey Woodpit Barbecue on Main Street in Julian. On Sunday, December 15th, from 3 to 4 p.m. at the Visitor's Center Theater, the Mission Trails Regional Park in San Carlos is featuring a free musical concert. The musical group Many Strings consists of Chris and Jamie Burns. James is an accomplished hammer dulcimer musician, and Chris accompanies her on acoustic guitar. They will perform a mix of American, Celtic, and classic melodies, holiday favorites, winter-themed instrumentals, and beautiful Christmas classics from the Renaissance to present. The MTRP Foundation Concert Series is free to the public and scheduled at 3 p.m. on the third Sunday of each month in the Visitor's Center Theater, with a reception immediately following. The Chancel Choir of the United Church of Christ of La Mesa will present a free musical celebration of the Christmas story on Sunday, December 15th at 10 a.m., at the church on Kelton Avenue in La Mesa. This Lloyd Larson cantata is entitled Behold the Star. A Julian specialty, the Julian Christmas Train Express, will be running through December 31st, where guests can take a one-mile train ride to an 1870 gold rush mine with some surprises along the way. A Red Door Christmas is a play that takes a trip down memory lane and celebrates the little joys that make Christmas magical. Performances run from Wednesday, December 12th through Sunday, December 22nd at the Red Door Playhouse on Pioneer Way in El Cajon. Christian Youth Theater San Diego presents a show that takes the commercial racket out of the holidays and brings it back to the basics. Like Charlie Brown without the right tree, Ralphie without his Red Ryder BB gun, and the Who's without their presence. Performances are on Thursdays, Saturdays, and Sundays at varying times. Their website at cytsandiego.org has more information. The Santa Train, the North Pole Limited, is accepting reservations for its ongoing Christmas rail journey every Saturday and Sunday from December 6th through December 21st. There will be elves serving hot chocolate and a Christmas story told aboard the Limited. Then Santa visits with all the children on the train on the way back to Campo. Reservations are required in advance. Now for a preview of upcoming events for early next week, a free Christmas concert will be held Monday, December 16th from 5:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Maxine Theater in Valley Center. The bands and choirs of the Valley Center Middle and High School will perform at the Maxine Theater. The Lake Murray Walk and Talk Group of La Mesa meets on Tuesday, December 17th from 9 to 10:30 a.m. at Lake Murray. Led by Mission Trails Regional Park Trail Guide Nancy Clement, this is an informative talk and guided nature walk that meets by the boat docks and is held on the third Tuesday of each month unless it is raining. A glass painting class will be presented at the San Pasqual Winery Tasting Room and Gallery in the Village of La Mesa on Tuesday, December 17th. From 5:30 to 8 p.m. The class includes paint, materials, and instruction for painting two glasses and a glass of wine to drink. Additional glasses may be decorated. No artistic ability is required, and they have stencils for participants to use if needed. The San Diego Concert Band launches its 25th anniversary season with a holiday concert at the Joan B. Kroc Theater called Joyous Celebration, on Tuesday, December 17th at 7 p.m. Under the direction of Roy Anthony Jr., the San Diego Concert Band will perform a variety of holiday and winter season selections, including some band members' favorites from the past 25 years. All of these events and more can be found on our calendar and events and in our festival and events section at www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County!
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
Elected officials and business leaders from the United States and Mexico held a groundbreaking ceremony on Tuesday for a new state highway project aimed at reducing border wait times and improving cross-border commerce. State Route 11 will be a four-lane highway connecting a new planned port of entry called Otay Mesa East to the state highway system. The 2.5-mile project will be built in three segments. The first segment, which cost $112 million,
is starting construction now. It includes connectors to State Route 905 and a stretch of new highway. Segments planned for the future will extend the highway to the border and create a new border crossing. Future plans call for toll roads approaching the border crossing both north and south of the border. And if you don't want to wait in long lines, you will have the option to pay a fee to reach the border faster. Reporting for East County Magazine and KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Helen O'Field from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. Back in the saddle for our next conversation is Gary McClintock, founder of McClintock Saddleworks in Descanso. Gary is famous for his beautiful custom-made saddles with their gleaming leather and hand-tooled detailing. But he is equally famous for his knowledge of the world of Los Vaqueros, the cowboys of the Southwest and Mexico. Gary, welcome back.
Thanks, Helen. It's really great to be back with you. I enjoy being around you. You're such a lovely, vivacious person that it always is encouraging to me.
Oh, gee willikers. Now tell me, cowboys in general have such a hold on the American psyche. For you, what is it about the story of the vaquero that is so compelling?
You know, I think where that started for me was with Granville Martin, who I came to know. I wasn't that thrilled and overwhelmed with the cowboy as a rodeo cowboy. I was more interested in the guy that rode the backcountry and handled cattle and maybe had a little small ranch. You know, what we were presented during the 50s and all the cowboy shows that were on TV, that just sounded like a great way to live. You know, that was exciting. Not necessarily the rodeo cowboy, but the ranch cowboy. That's what got my attention. And when I met Granny, he introduced me to the whole world of the California vaquero, which was a whole different way of doing things than even the Texas cowboy.
Gary, for our listeners, Granville or Granny Martin is a historian?
Yeah, he was a great historian. He didn't plan to be that way, but he just got all wrapped up in everything. First, he was a rancher, a vaquero is what he called himself. They would go vaquero and not cowboy, and he would always refer to it that way because it was a little bit different way of handling cattle and being that type of a range cowboy is what he was.
It sounds like you're referring to the vaquero as a kind of steward of the land.
That's a different thing altogether. Definitely a steward of the land. You know, if you look to what an environmentalist is today, they had to be that way. They had to make the land produce for them. If the land wasn't taken care of, it wouldn't produce. Of course, you had to have rain, which is what they all pray for, to make the grass grow. But they were very essential stewards of the land that preserved the land for us to what we... Really, it's been abused, so it's not as nice as it was in their day. I mean, there's a different philosophy that's out there with the different agencies of the government as far as how the backcountry should be handled. But in his day, it was the cattlemen that were foremost survivors. I mean, it was a ranching community, a ranching society that existed with 90% of the people living out on the land, where today it's reversed. You know, it's probably 99% of the people live.
So we're talking about a whole ranching society in parts of California, Arizona, New Mexico, and spilling over the border.
Oh, yeah.
Into Mexico.
Yeah, Mexico's really where it all comes from. And that, you know, as they moved north back in the 1700s, they settled California and they settled New Mexico. They settled Arizona. And that was the only thing there was to do, is raise cattle, and you needed horses, so they raised horses as well. That was like making automobiles in that day. You had to have good horses, so along with the cattle came the good horses.
So there's a big Spanish colonial backstory.
Absolutely.
To the world of the vaqueros.
Oh, that's because, who it is.
Like, where do horses come from?
Yeah, exactly. That's a good question, but they introduced the... As far back as the when Cortez came, Cortez was the one that introduced horses in 1519. Yeah. He brought, I don't know, maybe 19 or 20 horses with him, They were in Hispaniola before that, down by Cuba, and some were in Cuba. They were starting to raise them there. They were getting ready for an intrusion, an entrada into Mexico. It wasn't Mexico at the time. It became Nueva España to them,
yes.
But it was just a big landmass out there that they wanted to explore.
And those horses then multiplied, or they ran away?
No, they were very well under control. The end of breeding program came along with that. That's
okay.
Those particular, there was a breeding program in the islands down by Hispaniola. That's why they had the horses there. They were breeding them there.
Oh,
and then as they brought them over and they had the opportunity, once the conquest was done, which didn't take much, they started breeding, and some went to South America, some went to North America. So different breeding programs went throughout all of Mexico.
So it's fair to say that we have historic horses, that the vaqueros you're talking about in a contemporary sense are actually riding and herding on horses with this long pedigree.
Well, it's so mixed at this time, it's really hard to... What you say is true if you look to the Mustang. That probably has more of the Andalusian, the Lusitanos, the horses that came with the conquest. Those were the horses that propagated, and they did run loose after a while, but that was later. You know, at first, they all had to run loose because they didn't have fences. You know, they had to eat, so they let them run loose. But that's when the Indians got all the horses. They stole them from the Spanish and started their own breeding program.
Yeah.
See, they really had no horses to speak of until... Really, Father Kino came into what they called Pimeria Alta, which is the northern part of Mexico and the southern part of Arizona and New Mexico.
And Father Kino is?
Kino's the one, a Jesuit priest that introduced all that. And he had very little protection, but had a lot of livestock, a lot of cattle. And he introduced it to the Indians. He wanted them to propagate them. He wanted them to get involved with ranching. And they did.
Father Kino was a Jesuit, so he predated Father Sarah, who
was
Franciscan. Yeah,
yes.
There was a kind of warfare between the two orders. If I'm recalling this correctly, Royal Spain removed the Jesuits.
Absolutely, that's exactly right.
They sent in the Franciscans.
Became very jealous of the Jesuits. Carlos III, the king over there in Spain, was thinking that the Jesuits were taking advantage of him and holding back from him taxes or gold or something. And in reality, they really were not. They had very little, and they were a very selfless people. They lived for the Indians that they were trying to convert.
Gary, you mentioned fencing, and there is that old song, "Don't Fence Me In,"
yeah.
And which is kind of the anthem,
yeah.
The national anthem for a cowboy or a vaquero.
Yeah.
And really, in point of fact, for a modern vaquero, how much fencing is there? Is there room to be a vaquero?
You know, Helen, that's a great observation because it's literally gone. There's very few places where you have open range. I mean, there's some of that some places, but nothing like what was back during that era. I mean, the whole world moved on horseback. The horses were trained so well because there were so many of them to select from to begin with after they perpetuated, especially in California. The great horse herds just multiplied. They dissolved the missions in 1835, so... About that, before that point, maybe between 1820 and 1835 was when there was such a entourage of horses grazing throughout California and the Southwest. Well, from that, they could make a good horse because they had nothing but cattle and horses. And cattle, working cattle with a young horse gives them a reason to turn, to stop, to go, to back up, to do all the different things that we require of a well-trained horse. It just came from natural working, and they were better. One horse might be better than another because of natural selection. One was just a little bit better than the other one at doing this, and as a consequence, if they could perpetuate that, they would. But they didn't necessarily ride the mares.
In the folklore of the cowboy and the vaquero, Is there anything similar to the rules of the road for cars and boats where you have to give way? So say two vaqueros are meeting on a narrow trail on a mountain grade. Who gets to go first?
That's a pretty interesting question, actually. Probably not so much of a reality. Some situations would develop that way. There is some etiquette regarding the herdsmen who are handling the stock, cattle, sheep, goats, whatever it is. There is kind of a rite of passage, like if you're working the right side of the herd, you don't cross in front of the guy that's working to the left of you. He shifts to the left and you go with him.
Okay.
More like a dance, you know, instead of crossing in front of each other.
Okay. And
there is that.
Is that where do-si-do comes from?
I don't know. It could be.
Are you saying that it's the tradition of the vaquero is handed down in families?
Oh, absolutely. From generation to generation. In fact, we made a video about the cowboys in Baja, and it kind of goes into a little of that and how it was from father to son. Yeah. The tradition was handed down. I mean, it was unfortunate for those who didn't have as much land. They couldn't get it handed to them like me. I wasn't in a family of that, so I kind of was
I've
left
seen
out of that.
I've seen that film, and it's 1 hour, and it's very good. How could our listeners order that, or can they order it?
Oh, sure, yeah. We have at my saddle shop there in Descanso, we always have copies available. Okay. And they can call us at the saddle shop. I mean, we're on the internet, yeah. BookedTalkSaddles.com, we're there. And you can find our phone number and everything's
right on the website, and
yeah.
Then you can order right there.
It's better to call and order.
Yes.
I'm not set up to order off our website because
yeah.
I want to make it more of a personal thing.
Gary, you are terrific. Thank you so much for stopping by. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen O'Field.
This is Leon Thompson with the Sports Report from East County Magazine on KNSJ. The San Diego State Aztecs football team is headed to Idaho for the Potato Bowl game. The Aztecs will face off against Buffalo at Bronco Stadium in Boise, Idaho, and the game will be televised on ESPN. The Aztecs captured second in Mountain West's West Division, taking third place overall. The team finished the season with a 7-5 record. SDSU Athletics Director Jim Sterk said players are excited to play in the Idaho Potato Bowl and called this a great day for the Aztecs. This will be SDSU's fourth straight bowl game, a school record. Before, it took 41 years for the team to reach four bowl game appearances. Fans who want to head to Idaho for the big game can purchase tickets at GoAztecs.com or at the Aztec ticket office at Qualcomm Stadium, with proceeds benefiting Aztec athletics. You can also sponsor a band, Spirit Squad member, or underserved youth participating in the Potato Bowl game.
This is a public service announcement for the Mountain Health and Community Services. Mountain Health and Community Services is looking for a happy ending for a Christmas toy story. Serving rural areas of East County and other parts of San Diego for over 30 years, the nonprofit health organization needs hundreds of toys donated to give to low-income children at Christmas holiday parties this year. Usually the organization receives a grant for 400 toys from Mattel Toy, but this year that did not come through. These toys go to underserved kids in Hakumba, Campo, Alpine, downtown San Diego, and Escondido, so they need community help this year to help these children have a happy holiday season. They're asking anybody who can help to provide new unwrapped toys for children of all ages, boys and girls. The organization is also collecting canned and dry foods for the Campo Food Pantry, which helps local low-income families. Items needed include pasta, pasta sauces, tuna, peanut butter, cereals, and similar items. Toys and canned goods can be dropped off until December 17th at the Alpine Family Medicine at 1620 Alpine Boulevard in Alpine, or the Mountain Empire Family Medicine at 3115 Highway 94 in Campo. The holiday parties are always a big event. They include a family meal, crafts, toys for the children, a chat with Santa, and shopping at Santa's workshop. For more information or to volunteer to help the Mountain Health and Community Services with these events, visit www.mtnhealth.org.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
Did you know that your kitchen fat, oil, and grease left over from daily cooking or deep frying a Thanksgiving turkey can be recycled and turned into biofuel? EDCO has a free, safe, and environmentally friendly program that turns fat into fuel. Residents are asked to simply collect used discarded fat, oil, and grease in a leak-proof container and drop it off free of charge at any of EDCO's buyback centers. It will then be processed, filtered, and converted into biodiesel by a third-party processor and used to power vehicles. Be sure not to mix your kitchen fat, oil, and grease with anything else, such as motor oil, that could prevent it from being converted to biodiesel. EDCO has buyback stations for recycling in East County in La Mesa and Lemon Grove. The La Mesa facility is located at 8184 Commercial Street. Lemon Grove's is at 6700 Federal Boulevard, and both are open from 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. daily. For information on these and other EDCO recycling centers countywide, visit www.edcodisposal.com. Just in time for the holidays, El Cajon resident Jackie Bradfield and her 6-year-old stepdaughter Haley have new holiday decorations to replace ones that were stolen. The heartwarming donations came from a secret Santa with help from El Cajon residents Dina Weil and Shirley Johnson. Last week, just after putting up holiday decor, including an inflatable Santa, Bradfield heard a commotion. She came outside to find everything missing, like a scene straight out of How the Grinch Stole Christmas. Johnson and Weil delivered new decorations last week, complete with a wreath, Santa, and an inflatable reindeer. The donations came after Bradfield posted about the theft on an online police message board. The anonymous donor who aided in the effort wanted Bradfute's daughter to know that there are good people in the world. Bradfute said she was moved nearly to tears as she looked upon the donated Christmas display. Haley saw the decorations on Thanksgiving Day, thanks to the kindness of community members. "It makes me feel really blessed," Bradfute said, adding, "It feels like the holidays again." This is Miriam Raftery with an important consumer alert for parents this holiday season. Dangerous or toxic toys can still be found on America's store shelves, according to the U.S. Public Interest Research Group's 28th annual Trouble in Toyland report. The survey of hazardous toys found that despite progress, consumers must still be wary when shopping this holiday season. The report reveals results of laboratory tests on toys for toxic chemicals, including lead, cadmium, and phthalates, all of which can have serious adverse health effects on development of children. The survey also found small toys that pose a choking hazard, extremely loud toys that threaten children's hearing, and toy magnets that can cause serious injury if swallowed. The list of dangerous toys also includes items by major toy manufacturers, such as Mattel, as well as items sold by major retail chains such as Walmart, Toys R Us, and Babies R Us. One of the most dangerous toys listed this year is the Captain America Soft Shield, which contains 29 times more lead than allowed by law. Fisher-Price's Loving Family Outdoor Barbecue and The Littlest Pet Shop by Hasbro both contain pieces that could choke small children. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles pencil cases by Innovative Design contain cadmium, a toxic metal, while Mattel's Laugh and Learn remote was deemed a noise hazard at 85 decibels. That's 20 points higher than allowed by law, high enough to cause hearing loss. Now, the good news is that over the last 5 years, stronger rules have helped get some of the most dangerous toys and children's products off the market. Patty Davis, a spokesperson for the Consumer Product Safety Commission, said that toys are safer now than they have been in the past. Seizures of defective toys at U.S. ports are up, and nearly 10 million units of toys have been stopped at ports in the last 5 years. Those potentially dangerous toys did not make it into our stores or the hands of our children. However, not all toys are complying with these new laws, and holes in the safety net remain. So, parents, be vigilant in researching toys before purchasing them for your children. To get the full list of dangerous toys, you can search online for the Trouble in Toyland report, which we will be posting at eastcountymagazine.org. East County Magazine has won more than 50 major journalism awards with reporting that's making a positive difference in our region. The East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ covers important topics such as fire protection, energy and environmental issues, stories from East County's Native American and Chaldean communities, rural issues, and helping local veterans. Please help keep the East County Magazine show on KNSJ by donating or making a sustaining monthly pledge at www.knsj.org. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.